This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Indiana Attorney General Todd Rokita issued an advisory opinion recently on the use of Black Lives Matter in schools. Rokita's opinion states that it's a political organization and shouldn't be used. With us now is Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and Jeannie Lindsay, education reporter with Indiana Public Broadcasting, to get more into the details on this. Brandon, can you give us some insight into this opinion and why the Attorney General felt the need to issue it?
Well, he was asked about this, he says, by two state lawmakers, two Republicans, Michelle Davis and John Crane, I believe, Representative Michelle Davis, Senator John Crane, both Republicans, as I said. So a lot of times with the case of advisory opinions from the Attorney General's office, it's prompted by someone reaching out, someone in government reaching out and saying, hey, I would like your opinion on this. But I do have to stress, it is an opinion. It carries no force or effect of law or anything like that. It is the state's top attorney saying, this is my legal opinion. Now, why he felt the need to issue it beyond being asked by these two lawmakers for his opinion is that these are obviously issues, the discussion of race and equality and equity and diversity and inclusion in schools and curriculum is obviously a very serious topic that's being debated all across the country. These are the issues that are getting a lot of attention. And I don't think I'm telling tales out of school here when I say that Todd Rokita is someone who likes attention. So he wanted to insert himself into this discussion in any way he could. And this was a perfect opportunity for him to do that.
Jeannie, what was the response like in the community of parents and teachers?
Yeah, so I mean, it depends on which community you're in and who you are. I've seen folks on social media who are supportive of Rokita's take on this. Some of those are the same folks who are supporting his parent bill of rights that talks about critical race theory, COVID-19 vaccines and masks, and some of the other hot button issues that, you know, as Brandon mentioned, we've seen pop up in a few school board meetings across the state and in other parts of the country that have gotten a lot of news coverage and attention. You know, people who really want to maybe diffuse some of that, who don't want schools getting, quote unquote, too political. But there certainly has been pushback in places that have talked about or attempted to limit school posters or conversations about Black Lives Matters. I know Westfield Washington Schools has been dealing with this for a couple of months now. And there was a situation in Muncie schools shortly after Rokita issued this opinion about Black Lives Matter. And those were, you know, student protests, parents were involved. So definitely different types of engagement on this. But teacher unions are not particularly shy about having an opinion on things like this from the teacher side of things. And, you know, back in 2020, during the protests after the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, I mean, ISTA and the American Federation of Teachers, you know, they expressed their support for Black Lives Matter. Then after Rokita's opinion this time, they didn't really come out with any sort of formal statement, but ISTA President Keith Gamble was asked about this on a press conference a couple weeks ago where they were talking about teacher pay and bargaining rights. And he said that it's important for students to feel welcomed and safe, even by something as small as a sign or a sticker in a classroom, and that teachers should have the freedom to do what they think will, you know, best provide that sort of environment. I talked to the president of the Concerned Clergy of Indianapolis recently, which does a lot of work on social and civic issues. I'm sure people who are listening are familiar. And the president signed on to a letter with other religious leaders who called this opinion and Rokita's remarks about race in schools as racist. They said it's a dog whistle. It's coded language, not for Black and brown people. And so there's certainly a mix and no shortage of folks talking about this take and the impact it has and, you know, could have on schools and students in those classrooms.
Well, speaking of sort of perhaps looking at this from a lens where it doesn't lend people to feel included, Brandon, when issuing a statement like that, it seems to send a message that any type of movement to promote human rights isn't welcome, particularly if it comes from a community of color. Is that something that lawmakers are aware of?
Oh, I'm sure lawmakers are aware of that, but they don't care. This is a message that speaks to the conservative Republican base from Todd Rokita. And so it's exactly why two Republican lawmakers asked him for the advisory opinion. It's a way we want Black Lives Matters out of schools. That was the message that Republican lawmakers who asked him for this were hoping to get. And that's what he delivered, because he's thinking about, first and foremost, I would think, his Republican base. Todd Rokita is an ambitious person, which there's nothing wrong with being ambitious. And so he's thinking about his next job or running for re-election as attorney general. And in order to do that, you have to win Republican votes in a state like Indiana. And so in order to get things like Republican votes, you have to speak to the issues that Republican voters seem to care about right now. And this is one of those issues. So they don't seem to want to attract black and brown votes in Indiana, because evidence would suggest they don't need black and brown votes to win. So why should they care?
Well, also, when you mentioned earlier about, maybe part of this is for attention, is that part of sort of the whole political playing field where you jump on a hot button topic and issue something, even though it's really not going to be a legal change of any sort?
Yeah, again, and we're talking about it right now, It's not like we should ignore this, but we're talking about it right now, which is exactly what Todd Rokita wants. He doesn't care if people think he's wrong for doing this, because he believes that the majority of people that he needs to win votes in the future and the majority of people who support him think that he's right. And so getting his message out there is really all that he cares about in this sense, because a lot of times advisory opinions by attorneys general are for complex legal issues that local government leaders or schools or whomever are trying to get guidance on. I don't necessarily think this falls into that as squarely as some other issues that attorneys general have sent advisory opinions on. But I also want to talk about the impact of this, because Jeannie mentioned that in the wake of Todd Rokita sending this or issuing this advisory opinion, you have the incident at Muncie Community Schools, which, if I've read this correctly, was not about simply a Black Lives Matter sign being posted in a school. It was part of a school project. It was something that students had done as part of an assignment, and the security services there took it down. Now, they can point to the attorney general's advisory opinion as the reason they did that, which is partly what Todd Rokita wants here. His opinion doesn't carry, like I said, any force of law, but school officials who are looking to chase Black Lives Matters out of their schools or issues like that will use it as an excuse to say, well, the attorney general says we should do this, so let's do it.
Jeannie, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, schools are interested, I think, in, you know, diffusing some of the tension that conversations about this have brought to their school board meetings, right? I mean, schools have a big job to do, especially with the pandemic, you know, affecting student learning as deeply as it has, particularly for communities that have continued to be underserved, which includes Black and Brown students, English learners, special education. So I think that, you know, the conversation about this, it's not surprising to see this from Rokita. We've seen, as Brandon mentioned, I mean, there are Republicans across the country who have been talking about this. The governor-elect of Virginia had talked a lot about race and schools and his takes on, you know, education and how that should or should not be talked about. And so it's really not surprising. And I don't think that it would be shocking or any stretch to say that, you know, we very well may see this pop up in more campaigns when we get back to, you know, election cycles that are, you know, electing some of these big positions. So I think that yeah, there's certainly an interest of, you know, firing up people and continuing to talk about this to, you know, make this a central piece or at least a large piece of some of those campaigns. Meanwhile, schools are just trying to educate kids and support them, you know, as human beings and prepare them for the real world. So, yeah, there's a lot of interesting dynamics that are going to be circling around this, I'm sure. And especially with the legislative session coming up and this being an inquiry from, you know, state lawmakers, I'll be interested to see what happens, you know, during session, if there are, what legislation is proposed and how it moves to, you know, potentially give teeth or, you know, more, I don't know, legally binding, you know, momentum behind this, especially because, I mean, just revisiting sessions past, there have already been bills about what's posted in classrooms. There were efforts to get In God We Trust, the United States and Indiana state flag posted in classrooms. So the symbolism and signage that is featured in schools certainly has been of interest. And now there's this very, you know, intense topic that's getting a lot of attention from all sides that I think this is kind of just another piece and sort of the beginning of what we might see coming down the line.
And to clarify, Jeannie, this is all to do with public schools, correct? This doesn't affect private schools at all.
Yeah. I mean, anytime you're talking about, you know, the operations of private schools, that's kind of a whole different beast. There's, you know, obviously some that participate in public funding programs like school vouchers, school choice. But yeah, this is largely focused at public schools that are managed and funded and run by public funds in the state.
Brandon, is it unusual for the attorney general to interfere with public schools? I mean, maybe interfere isn't the right word, I guess, because this is part of the state, these public schools. But is it unusual to take a step like this, or is this routine?
No, I wouldn't call it routine. Every attorney general is going to do the job a little differently, depending on their philosophy of law and things like that, and how they and what they choose to focus on within the duties of that office. I can't really see former Attorney General Greg Zeller sending out something like this necessarily. But the last two attorneys general, who were more sort of starkly partisan, I would say, Curtis Hill and now Todd Rokita, this is less surprising. Am I surprised Todd Rokita did this? No. Am I surprised an attorney general of Indiana would do this? Maybe a little bit.
Well, Jeannie, what's next? Any idea on whether schools are just going to sort of ignore this and take it as just an opinion, or do you think folks are actually getting on board?
Yeah, I mean, there have been schools that have been talking about this before Rokita's opinion, and now there will be plenty, I'm sure, talking about it afterwards. Like I said earlier, I mean, I think schools are really less interested in having some of these hot button issue debates on, you know, such a large scale, and really getting back down to the mission of, you know, serving kids, you know, the education that they need and supporting them socially. So trying to find that balance, I'm sure schools are going to be figuring out what it is that they're going to do, depending on what their community has said and how their school board meetings have looked.
Well, thank you both for joining us for this discussion. Up next, we'll continue our discussion with Brandon as we learn more about the upcoming legislative session. And we'll be joined by Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soap. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. We're discussing the upcoming legislative session with Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter with the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. What to expect and things to look out for. Brandon, let's start with the COVID vaccine mandate. How are things looking right now in Indiana?
Well, the last week and a half has been interesting. So to very quickly catch everybody up, in case you haven't been listening to your Indiana Public Broadcasting stations or reading the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette, as you all should be all the time, in the last couple of weeks, Indiana House Republicans and Republicans at the State House suddenly announced that they were going to come in for a special one-day session that was supposed to be the beginning of this week and pass a bill that would, on its face, help Indiana end the public health emergency around COVID-19 at the request of Governor Eric Holcomb to get three changes to state law so he could do that. And then they added on this bit about effectively banning private companies from enforcing COVID-19 vaccine mandates. They had a big hearing last week, 2 days before a major U.S. holiday, about that bill, at which a lot of people on both sides, quite honestly, were opposed to it. Some the state's top business and healthcare organizations who said this is not something the state should be doing. Private businesses should be allowed to make those decisions for themselves. While folks on the other side who don't like these vaccine mandates actually thought the bill didn't go far enough. They want really just an outright ban on the mandates entirely. The Republicans then suddenly backed down a day later and said, well, we're not going to come into session, this special one-day session, and we'll wait until we come back in January. But then House Republicans this week have unveiled their top priority bill for the 2022 session. And it's basically that bill. With a very tiny change, it's the same bill that effectively bans private companies from enforcing these mandates. So that's going to be obviously a major topic of discussion once lawmakers return in January.
And just to clarify, is this being put in place to counter the federal mandate?
I mean, there's certainly a lot of anger around the federal mandate, the federal mandates, both the OSHA rule, which affects any business with at least 100 employers, as well as the healthcare worker and federal contractor policies, which are three separate things. But no, this wouldn't affect those, because if those federal rules, any one of the three of them, are allowed to go, allowed to take effect, which we, you know, we're seeing the court battles play out there so far, not to the president's in the president's favor. But if any of them are allowed to take effect, this state law would have no impact whatsoever on those categories of workers, because federal rules trump state laws.
So it sounds like another case of, I mean, I wouldn't call it an opinion, but it sounds a little bit kind of like that if the federal stuff is still enforceable. Nikki, it seems that, you know, as though many issues in the state fall along party lines, would you say it's the same for the COVID vaccine mandate, or does it seem that the parties are more on the same page here?
Oh, no, it's absolutely party line. It's you know, virtually all Republicans. I mean, when they planned this one day session, you have to remember they thought that they would have 2/3 votes in both chambers, because that's what's needed to suspend rules to hear a bill that fast. And I think they were surprised after that 7 hours to realize there was a lot of opposition and a lot of confusion. And I did just want to note one thing. Obviously, it would not impact the federal mandates, but it would indeed impact some businesses here in Indiana that are on their own implementing vaccine mandates. For instance, Eli Lilly has one. You know, IU Health has one, several others. So those have been going into effect in recent months, regardless of the federal mandate. And that is what this bill is aiming to get at.
Oh, interesting. And I mean, I'm just trying to like wrap my head around this. So is anyone opposing this aside from, like, let's say Democrats versus Republicans? Are there any folks that are sort of in between or on both sides? I don't know.
I mean, businesses are opposing it just on the sense of, and like I said, while there are some businesses doing this, it's a small minority. Businesses basically want to be left alone. They don't want the federal government to tell them to mandate a vaccine, and they don't want the state government to tell them they can't mandate a vaccine. They want their own autonomy to make those decisions. Otherwise, I mean, it's pretty largely following on party lines as far as I can see. What do you think, Brandon?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say so. I mean, the fact that they didn't come back in and do this one-day session would suggest that perhaps there are some Republicans. As you mentioned, they needed the 2/3 votes, which is, for the most part, almost the entire Republican caucuses in the House and Senate. They have a little more than 2/3 in both chambers, but it's only a little bit. So that would suggest that perhaps there are at least a few Republicans who might be a little uncomfortable with just how far the bill might go. But we won't really see that play out until the legislative session now begins, when we can start to see some actual debate and actual votes on the board.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the Parents' Bill of Rights, and I'm not trying to make this at all Todd Rokita show, but Brandon, the Parents' Bill of Rights came out, and how does that fit into the upcoming legislative session? And if you can sort of give us a summary of that for people who don't know what it is.
Sure. Todd Rokita issued his so-called Parent Education Bill of Rights, which on its face seems relatively harmless, which is he's just letting people know what rights they already have under various state and federal laws. So things like you have the right and expectation to question and address your child's school officials via letters, emails, in-person meetings. You have the right to question review curriculum by questioning your local school board and school administrators during public comment periods at public meetings. You have the right to run as a candidate for your local school board. You have the right to access educational materials and curriculum taught to your child in the classroom. You have the right to receive your child's student health records, to make medical decisions on behalf of your child. There are 10 technically things that he's outlined in his most recent update of that. All of them, again, none of that is outrageous. None of that defies explanation. It all makes a lot of sense, and it's a good resource, as we've seen a lot more interest and attention for one reason or another on what's being taught in schools all across the country. And we've seen a lot more tension at school board meetings here and around the country. It makes sense for a public official, particularly someone who's positioned to, you know, study the law as the attorney general is, to say, here are your rights under the law. But then it goes deeper. where he starts to explain a lot of these things, and he starts to inject his opinion about critical race theory and the 1619 Project and Black Lives Matter and things like this, where you could argue that Todd Rokita starts to go a little bit farther than what his official capacity should be doing.
Is this kind of sort of shift in focusing on these kinds of topics part of just the way politics has been headed in the last several years? Is it just part of this movement, or is Indiana just always been this way?
No, I mean, part of it's where politics has been moving, but it's also, again, where Todd Rokita is. If the attorney general were a different person who perhaps didn't want to focus on these sort of controversial hot button issues that would garner them attention and particularly attention from the people that they hope are supporting them and giving them money, then we might not see something like this from the attorney general's office. But given its current occupant, again, this doesn't surprise me in the least.
Nikki,
I also find it. Oh, I was just going to jump in really quickly. I also find it really interesting that we've heard nothing on these topics from our new Secretary of Education under Governor Holcomb. And, you know, they made this an appointed position. And so I think it's interesting that we're hearing it a lot from the Attorney General, but not from the actual entity that runs education in the state.
I wonder what kind of message that sends then, that maybe it's not as big of an issue as we're led to believe, perhaps?
I mean, it's important to, I mean, I got to tell you, our education reporter has covered months and months and months of these testy hearings on a number of issues, not just masks, but CRT and social emotional learning and, you know, content of books. And so there are these groups of parents that are really riled up on these sort of topics that are getting all the attention, and Todd Rokita is definitely, you know, jumping on that to get his name out.
Well, Nikki, with supporters of the Parents' Bill of Rights, I think some of them are hoping it'll curb things like critical race theory. How big of an issue is school curriculum going to be in the upcoming legislative session?
Yeah, it's definitely going to be an issue. House Speaker Todd Houston mentioned the topic during his Organization Day speech. It was sort of a quick glancing sentence, something about transparency on curriculum. So I'm not so sure that the caucus as a whole will get into the details of banning certain things, but they're certainly going to focus on making, you know, curriculum more available to the parents to review and to see what's going on in the classroom. There will certainly be bills by some Republicans banning things like CRT and things like that. Although it's a lot easier to say than to write in a state law, given how, you know, the very idea of what critical race theory is, I think, is very subjective.
Are there any bills related to this that you're seeing, Brandon, specifically towards a curriculum or critical race theory?
We haven't seen bills generally filed yet. The one that's on the list right now is the one as I mentioned, House Bill 1001, which is their top priority about vaccine mandates. So as Nikki just said, I'm sure we will see plenty of bills related to this subject. The question is which of these bills will be taken seriously and will actually advance through the process, because, of course, there are thousands of bills that are authored and only a few hundred that actually pass, particularly in a short session like we're about to go into. That's only several weeks long. I will say to Nikki, Nikki just brought up this point at the end, which is when we talk about what are these bills going to be, which is the key here, which is how are they written? How are you having this conversation about what you want schools to teach? Which is, if you authored a bill that said critical race theory can't be taught in schools, I don't know of a school that would oppose it, because critical race theory is a legal theory that is taught in graduate level courses at the college level. It's really a law school thing. So Indiana K-12 schools aren't teaching critical race theory, but that's not what people are upset about. So, and you have to be careful with how you write this sort of thing, because as we've seen in other states, you know, we saw the leaked audio of a meeting that a school administrator had with teachers in Texas after a bill along these lines passed in that state, where, you know, they had to be careful about teaching the Holocaust because they had to have differing views on it. Now, I don't know if Indiana lawmakers want schools teaching the other side of the Holocaust. Maybe there are some, but I don't think Indiana lawmakers generally want schools to be forced to do that. So they're going to have to be very careful. Well, they should be very careful about how they write these bills, because as Nikki said, it gets very subjective, and trying to write something very subjective into state law gets real tricky real fast.
Do you think any of this stuff might be put on the back burner, Nikki, with I think it's the emergency, state of emergency has been extended with also the Omicron variant and COVID in general. Do you think that'll have any effect on anything?
I mean, they plan to come in January and deal with the emergency. It's very clear Republicans want to end that emergency. It's also very clear that the governor wants the three administrative changes in law so the state isn't negatively impacted. Right now, that public health emergency gives us hundreds of millions in extra federal dollars that are coming to help our Medicaid and our food assistance programs. And so, but they could do those tiny things very quickly. But when they pulled in that vaccine mandate language that's new and novel and controversial, that is definitely what holds up that bill. So I do expect the health order to go away very quickly in session.
If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter with the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette, about the upcoming legislative session. Nikki, tax cuts are on the agenda. Can you tell us what lawmakers are looking at?
Yeah, this will be a fascinating discussion. Basically, we ended up with a massive $4 billion surplus that was unexpected. When COVID first initially hit, you know, everyone thought, oh my God, you know, and we did lose a lot of money initially. But then the federal government pumped so much money into the economy that things started picking up and sales taxes improved and, you know, the income taxes came back. And suddenly the state had way more money than we thought, and it triggered an automatic taxpayer refund, which is actually a tax credit on next year when you file your income taxes. But that has Republican lawmakers, especially in the House, sort of salivating at the idea of maybe it's time for a permanent tax cut if we keep bringing in all this extra money. And, you know, the easiest would be the income tax, because you can just change the rate. You know, right now, I think it's 3.23. To go down to 3, it would cost about $300 million annually. But the Senate Republicans don't appear as into this idea. They are nervous about sort of making a permanent cut so quickly before we see how the economy, you know, settles out from all this federal money.
Right. And Brandon, what are your thoughts on what's happening with tax cuts?
Yeah, there's another tax cut that was mentioned as a possibility by House Speaker Todd Houston, which is a change to the business personal property tax. So that's a tax on business equipment. Lawmakers a few years ago, when Governor Mike Pence proposed cutting that, made some changes and reductions to that. This would be a further change to that that sort of has to do with a threshold for when the value of that equipment is sort of stopped and things like that. So it would help businesses, but that... If let's just put it this way, if hypothetically the Speaker of the House were someone who wanted to run for, governor in a couple of years, he might want something like an income tax cut on his resume. So he might hypothetically be pushing something like that in an effort to get that added to his list of accomplishments, just hypothetically.
Well, when it comes to some of these tax cuts, I was reading something about, there's been mention about legalizing marijuana to offset some of the potential costs involved. Can you tell us about that, Brandon?
Yeah, there's zero chance of that happening in the near future. I mean, there just is. I mean, we have to be as honest as we can about this. It's absolutely a topic worth debate, because you have more and more people coming out for legalization. You have more and more pressure from surrounding states. Illinois is legalized. Michigan is legalized. Ohio, I think, is close on medical marijuana. Kentucky is discussing medical marijuana. But I would be surprised if Indiana lawmakers even publicly debate that issue in the 2022 session in any formal way. We'll see bills filed, certainly, probably even bills by both parties, because this is becoming a bipartisan issue. There are Republicans who are pushing for this as much as Democrats now. but it's just not going to happen for any reason in the near future.
Well, we'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll speak more with Brandon and Nikki about other topics coming up in the legislative session, things like child care, abortion, energy. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Childcare was something that took the spotlight during the early days of the pandemic as folks tried to figure out how to work but still find someone to care for their children since schools were closed down. The cost is often too much for working families. So what is the government doing to help families? With us again are Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter with the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette. Nikki, it seems like childcare will never be figured out at the federal or state level. Are we seeing anything in the upcoming legislative session that might be helpful?
I mean, there was some talk about, I think Republicans at least are acknowledging that the child care issue is impacting the economy, that some people haven't been able to return to work. You know, there are fewer child care slots, there are fewer child care workers. So it is at least getting to the front of, you know, their say. And there are Democrats pushing, for instance, saying, hey, you know, we have all this surplus money that we've discussed. And so why don't, when this federal child care tax credit or, you know, payments, which are set to end if they don't extend them, maybe the state could, you know, take those on. Even the Indiana Chamber of Commerce has suggested the state needs to get more involved in making sure there is both available child care, because like I said, slots itself are a hard issue, but also, you know, affordable childcare and quality.
Brandon, do you see any traction in this area?
It's tough to say. I think, to Nikki's point, she's exactly right that Republicans are certainly acknowledging this as something they need to pay attention to. And we heard the Indiana Chamber of, you know, she said the Indiana Chamber of Commerce made it one of their legislative priorities for the upcoming session. But I'll say at the Indiana legislative, at the Indiana Chamber of Commerce's legislative discussion panel, when they released their priorities and then had a discussion among the legislative leaders, Todd Houston, Speaker of the House, was asked about this, and he just called it a complicated topic, which if you're hoping something happens, doesn't exactly fill you with hope. But at the same time, you know, you heard Democrats say, well, businesses are trying to set up their own child care options because they are trying to attract workers back to the workforce. So can we help them with that? Can we give them some sort of tax credit for it, or some sort of, you know, anything to help incentivize, again, more child care opportunities? Because that's a big part of the struggle here, is just finding affordable options for parents. So I'm not going to rule out something happening. I'm just not sure how much attention they are ultimately going to devote to it this particular session in a short session.
Abortion has been a big topic on the federal and local level, especially what's happening in the Supreme Court. What is it looking like for lawmakers in the year ahead, Nikki? Will they continue to tackle this, or are they going to leave it up to the federal government before they weigh their own options?
I know of probably 10 lawmakers who are already preparing to file abortion legislation. Some of them like the new Texas route. Some of them are more interested in the ban out of, Georgia, I think, that was heard yesterday before the U.S. Supreme Court. I think leaders are, you know, keeping an eye on the Supreme Court, but at the same time, we're not going to know what they ruled before the end of session in March. So I do expect some sort of legislation to move forward, mirroring one or the other of those, and maybe just taking their chances that, you know, this is going to be resolved pretty quickly, because it appeared, at least from yesterday's hearings or, you know, oral arguments, that, you know, some sort of restriction, you know, it seems like it's probably coming down.
Indiana seems to be cited often as a place with a lot of restrictions already in place. Brandon, what more can be added to abortion laws here?
Yeah, well, like Nikki just said, I mean, mirroring the Mississippi law, which takes the age of viability from 20 weeks as it is in Indiana now down to 15. But if you read, you know, yeah, a lot of people reading the tea leaves of yesterday's oral argument suggest that it's possible the Supreme Court won't just say the Mississippi law is okay, and so now 15 weeks is the new standard that states that wish to restrict abortion can go to, which Indiana would certainly want to do and might do in this upcoming session in advance of such a ruling. But there are some who think they could overturn Roe entirely and allow states to completely ban abortion, full stop. And certainly there are lawmakers who've authored those bills here in Indiana in the past. They've never gotten anywhere because Indiana legislative leaders have said, well, you know, there's no way the Supreme Court is going to accept that. And so we'd be passing a blatantly unconstitutional law for no reason. That's no longer the case, at least not as obviously as it has been in the past. So I think to me, the question is not so much what more restrictions, because there are more restrictions. It's will they go all the way to try and ban abortion entirely in advance of a potential ruling from the Supreme Court next summer, or wait to see exactly what the Supreme Court does? And then if they allow them to ban abortion entirely, I mean, that'll be priority one in 2023.
Just to clarify, so could the state pass a law banning abortion completely without the federal government being involved?
No.
Sure.
Well, I mean, yeah, they could pass it, but it wouldn't be enforceable. Yeah.
They can pass it. Obviously, someone would sue over it and contest it in the courts. But, you know, they can pass whatever they choose if they're willing to take it up the line and defend it.
So I guess Indiana could set precedent if they wanted to and just go before, make a ruling before the Supreme Court.
Theoretically, I mean, I'm not sure leaders would quite go that far. There is a way, and we kind of did this before with sports gambling. There is a way they could pass a law that's contingent on a Supreme Court ruling. You know, they could pass a ban, you know, saying, you know, that goes into effect if the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, hands abortion back to the states to make decisions on.
Brandon, we've talked a lot about climate change and renewable energy on All In, and our guests yesterday touched on ways that Indiana is getting on board with efforts to combat climate change. One way is through renewable energy. How important is this topic to lawmakers? Do you see it as a top priority going into this legislative session?
I'm not entirely sure I'd say it's a top priority, but I think for some Republicans, and certainly a lot of Democrats, it is a priority. It is one of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce's legislative priorities for the session, which is a bill that they tried to do last year and that they're going to apparently try again, at least some version of, in the upcoming session, which is to say that for renewable energy projects around the state, local officials can't just outrightly ban them, because we've seen that across the state. We've seen counties that say, well, we don't want a wind farm here. We're just banning wind farms. Obviously, that makes it difficult to increase renewable energy production if you can't find any place to locate these facilities or these, you know, these implements of renewable energy, or, you know, rooftop solar bans or things like that. And there has been some, you know, it was Republicans who led those bills last session, notably the number two Republican in the Senate, Mark Messmer. And he said, you know, at that chamber luncheon that he's ready to go again. Even after that bill fell apart right at the end of session last year, and his floor speech about the bill falling apart said that trying to work with local officials, local government leaders on this bill, he described them as like being hostage takers who you give them everything they want and then they still shoot the hostage. He said that on the floor of the Senate. So it didn't end great for him last year, but he seems ready to jump back into it this year. We'll see if there are changes made to that sort of legislation that might make it more palatable for local officials, but it's a real push and pull between, you know, local control versus the state wanting not to restrict this, you know, burgeoning enterprise.
Nikki, do you think there will be a shift at the state house, or has there been a shift towards pushing through bills that promote renewable energy?
I think there has been a slight shift. I would call it begrudging. I think there are definitely members who recognize that we have to get a more, diverse grid on there. You know, it can't just be all coal anymore. And we know that's where it's going, but it's hard to sort of navigate how to get there. There's another bill that will likely be coming up on what we call net metering. There are some sections that in the code that are expiring unless lawmakers extend them, that give credits to people who use not only just are we talking about making the energy, now we're talking about people who use those alternative forms like solar or wind, and they get credits and stuff for putting excess on the grid. So if they don't extend those, there's a discussion to be had about why people would spend additional money up front to go that route if there's not sort of an incentive.
Are lobbyists playing a role at all in sort of holding back some of the renewable energy bills?
Well, I mean, of course, there are lobbyists on both sides of that issue, as well as both sides of every issue in the state house. So there has long been, a fight sort of between traditional energy and new energy. And it's all about, market and, people wanting, obviously, if we move away from coal, people lose their jobs. Are we replacing those jobs? Are they the same kind of jobs? And not only just the diversity of the energy, but the stability of it. We've seen problems in other states where, massive storms have shut things down for weeks upon end, or blizzards, those kinds of things. So it's about more than just having the diversity. It still needs to be stable and still needs to be affordable.
There's been reports about, and we've done a show about the biggest solar farm that's coming to the U.S. will be here in Indiana. Brandon, has that been well received by lawmakers? Because I mean, I think the governor was there at the groundbreaking.
Yeah, there are some. I loved Nikki's use of the word begrudging, because I think that's a great description of the shift that's taking place, at least for some Republicans at the State House on renewable energy. There are some Republicans who are very big on renewable energy. It's not a strictly partisan issue. I would say it's partisan here in part because that's who's controlling the General Assembly. If you have a state where the Democrats are controlling the General Assembly, you might have the most powerful interests, which typically in this area are utilities, who want the same restrictions and might get them because they are still powerful, regardless of sort of partisan ideology there. It's about who's in control. It's all about who's in control. So, yeah, there to your earlier question, there are lobbyists on both sides of this issue, but generally the lobbyists on the utility side have a little more muscle, if you will, certainly when it comes to things like campaign donations. Not the lobbyists directly make those, but the people they work for often do. So, there's, I'm sure there are plenty of Republicans at the State House and elsewhere who are very happy about the largest wind farm in the country coming to Indiana, because it just means jobs, it means, whatever else for Hoosiers, but it will rankle some in power, and they're going to push back against sort of what seems at this point the inevitable tide. I mean, we've seen utilities in Indiana moving away from coal because that's just the direction things are going, and lawmakers have been upset about that too.
Well, it seems the conversation globally and nationally about climate change has sort of shifted focus and people's priorities. And I wonder, Nikki, if that has played a role at all in politics in Indiana.
I'm sure it has. We're definitely moving at it a bit more slow, but that, is pretty typical of Indiana on some of these issues, especially being a red state. So, they're going to get there, but it just might take a couple more sessions to be, really open to the new renewables.
I want to go back a little to the earlier conversation we had on the Parents' Bill of Rights and the general atmosphere in the state. Indiana has been making headlines with some of the contentious school board meetings. Brandon, do you know if lawmakers plan to address any of that? Is that something that they would tackle at all?
I mean, not the school board meetings themselves necessarily. I mean, they're not going to do anything. I mean, well, you see, the Parents' Bill of Rights. It's Todd Rokita encouraging people, in a sense, to, saying, hey, you have the right and go talk to your public officials at these public meetings. Whether or not there's more explicit threats about that, which we've seen in some places, not necessarily here in Indiana, but certainly across the country, that's not legal, but I'm not sure that that's the focus of Republican leaders, really what they'll do is tackle the issues that people are so angry at these meetings about, which we've already talked about a lot here, which is, you know, what's being taught in schools, curriculum, transparency, critical race theory, racism in general, social emotional learning. All of these things are getting wrapped up into one, you know, and I got to be honest, I don't think there's a lot of understanding of the intricacies of this issue out there. And I'm not sure that's going to get solved by the Indiana General Assembly. I don't know if they can solve it. And I don't know if they're particularly interested in solving the intricacies of those things. They're interested in sending a message to all of these people who are really angry, who they want to vote for them.
I'm going to jump in on one thing there. One thing you are going to see is that there is going to be several bills to make school board elections partisan. Mm. Right now, when we run for school board elections in Indiana, you don't run as a Democrat or Republican or Libertarian. They're nonpartisan. So there are lawmakers who basically are saying, no, let's make this a partisan issue. They're dealing with things on a partisan basis, and we should accept it. We would be, I think there's something like 40 states who handle it the way we do. It's a very low number who have partisan school boards, but that seems to be a byproduct of all this that we will definitely see this session.
And that seems like it would cause quite a lot of controversy. I mean, I'm thinking all the divisive rhetoric unfolding in communities. Are lawmakers at all concerned? It doesn't seem like, I mean, I guess we're almost out of time here, but it doesn't seem like there's a clear sense of leadership on these issues of helping folks to come together.
Yeah, I mean, I think they see it more as parents having their say. So, you know, I think it might be a little different if they sat there and had people yell and scream at them and block them from getting to their cars and things like that. But they don't seem too concerned about those issues overall.
Well, Brandon, before we wrap up here, any other topics or issues we can look forward to in the upcoming session?
I don't have a specific one for you at this second, but I'll say that in general, there's always something that surprises us about a session. And obviously, I can't say what that is because it's a surprise. It'll be a surprise to all of us. But that there's always something that pops up, even in a short session, in the middle of it, where you didn't see it coming. It flares up. It might go away relatively quickly, as it sometimes does. But yeah, it'll flare up. It'll dominate the discussion for a few days or a week or two. And then it might die down and we'll be focused on all of these other issues that we've been talking about today and many, many more.
Well, thank you to both of us for joining us. I look forward to following up as the session gets underway. Brandon Smith, State House reporter, Indiana Public Broadcasting, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter with the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.